Herzlich willkommen bei Meditation Coaching and Life. Mein Name ist Michael Kurt, auch bekannt als Curse. Und die heutige Folge trägt den Titel Neugierde als Wunderwaffe. Und ist ein Gespräch mit dem Bestseller-Autor und weltweit erfolgreichen Coach Michael Bongay Stanier. Viel Spaß dabei. Herzlich willkommen euch allen nochmal hier zu dieser neuen Folge Meditation Coaching and Life. Und wenn ihr die letzte Podcast-Folge gehört habt, dann wisst ihr, dass ich schon ein bisschen auf diese Folge hingeteased habe. Und zwar ging es in der letzten Podcast-Folge darum, wie wir Überforderungen, Stresssituationen oder Situationen, die uns triggern, rechtzeitig erkennen können und wie wir unser eigenes Verhalten in diesen Situationen besser kennenlernen können und uns alternative Handlungsmöglichkeiten zurechtlegen und dann einüben können, um in schwierigen Situationen genauer hinschauen zu können und anders zu reagieren, als wir es eigentlich aus unserer Gewohnheit heraus tun würden. In diesem Gespräch, was ihr heute hier in dieser Podcast-Folge hört, geht es um viele Dinge, aber unter anderem auch darum, wie sich diese Methode einsetzen lässt und vor allem mit der Wunderwaffe Neugierde ergänzen lässt oder wie diese Wunderwaffe Neugierde in solchen Situationen einsetzbar ist, um wirklich fundamental Gewohnheiten zu ändern und einen viel offeneren, frischeren Ausblick auf das Leben, auf Gespräche, auf Menschen, die uns gegenüber sitzen und auf unser eigenes Erleben zu haben. Darüber, wie wir neugierig bleiben können, wie wir dadurch nicht nur unser Leben und unser Empfinden verändern können, sondern auch das von den Menschen, mit denen wir zu tun haben, vor allem auch, wenn wir in Positionen sind, in denen wir Teams organisieren oder unser eigenes Business aufbauen wollen oder sogar in Führungspositionen sind oder in beratenden Positionen sind oder auch einfach nur mit Freunden eine Übereinkunft treffen wollen. Darüber und über viele andere Dinge habe ich gesprochen mit Michael Bongay Stanier. Er ist Autor und er ist nicht nur Autor, er ist sogar Bestsellerautor. Sein Buch The Coaching Habit hat sich mittlerweile, glaube ich, 700, 800.000 Mal verkauft weltweit. Es ist in viele Sprachen übersetzt worden. Und der Untertitel von dem Buch The Coaching Habit ist, wie Sie mit Fragen führen und dabei das Potenzial Ihrer Mitarbeiter entfesseln. Und der andere Untertitel ist, reden Sie weniger und fragen Sie mehr. Und das passt auch, also ich meine, ich rede ja sehr viel hier in diesem Podcast, aber es passt auch sehr gut zu meiner eigentlichen grundsätzlichen Einstellung, was das Coaching-Thema angeht. Coaching ist für mich und auch für Michael Bongay Stanier, nicht Menschen Tipps zu geben, sondern Fragen zu stellen, zuzuhören und Menschen dabei begleiten, ihre eigenen Lösungswege zu finden. Und genau da schließt auch sein neues Buch an, es heißt The Advice Trap, also die Falle des Tippsgebens. Und auch da ist der Untertitel wieder sehr schön, Be Humble, also bleib bodenständig, bleib bescheiden, stay curious, bleib neugierig and change the way you lead forever. Und verändere dadurch die Art, wie du führst oder wie du mit Menschen bist für immer. Und vor allem über diesen Aspekt der Neugierde und des Neugierigseins und darüber, wie das nicht nur irgendwie so eine Sache ist, ach ja, ich bin grundsätzlich neugierig, sondern wie wir ganz bewusst unsere Neugierde schulen können und wie wir sie einsetzen können, um als wahre Wunderwaffe im zwischenmenschlichen und im Coaching-Kontext zu agieren und zu funktionieren. Darüber habe ich mit dem guten Mann gesprochen. Es war das erste Interview, was ich für diesen Podcast gemacht habe. Das erste war Bob Thurman. Das zweite war dieses hier. Deswegen erwähne ich am Anfang auch noch, dass es ein bisschen neu ist und dass ich noch nicht so viel gemacht habe und dass er wahrscheinlich der erste englischsprachige Gast ist. Aber mittlerweile ist er der, glaube ich, dritte englischsprachige Gast in diesem Podcast. Es war das erste englischsprachige Interview, was ich gemacht habe. Ich wollte aber trotzdem den Anfang nicht rausschneiden, sondern euch einfach mit auf die gesamte Reise dieses Gesprächs nehmen, weil sich da auch ganz wundervoll zeigt, was Michael für ein Mensch ist und was er nicht nur für Fachwissen hat, sondern auch was für Humor, was für schlaues Denken und was für auch einfach sehr große empathische zwischenmenschliche Qualitäten er mitbringt. Ich habe unser Gespräch wahnsinnig genossen. Ich habe sehr viel gelernt, wirklich sehr viel gelernt. Und ihr werdet im Laufe des Gesprächs auch hören, dass Michael wahnsinnig viele seiner Tools kostenlos zur Verfügung stellt. Ihr könnt auf seine verschiedenen Seiten gehen, die er im Gespräch erwähnt, die wir aber auch in den Shownotes und in der Beschreibung zu dieser Podcast-Episode natürlich auch nochmal verlinken und könnt euch dort vielseitige Tools runterladen. Ihr könnt euch Ausschnitte aus Büchern runterladen. Ihr könnt also wirklich, ohne einen einzigen Cent zu bezahlen, ganz, ganz, ganz viel Informationen bekommen und dann könnt ihr natürlich auch eins von seinen Büchern kaufen. Das erste Buch, The Coaching Habit, das gibt es schon auf Deutsch, das heißt auch auf Deutsch The Coaching Habit, und The Advice Trap gibt es noch nicht auf Deutsch, aber für diejenigen von euch, die Englisch lesen und verstehen, es ist einfach und klar geschrieben und wirklich sehr zu empfehlen. Ich wünsche euch jetzt viel Freude und vor allem viel positiven Input bei diesem Gespräch zum Thema Neugierde als Wunderwaffe.
All right, it looks like it's running. Perfect. Nice.
Excellent. Yeah,
thank you for also finding the time. It's true that you are my first remote non-German guest. So, and you might probably be either the first or the second person that people are going to hear in my entire podcast speaking English.
And I'm definitely the best looking guest you've ever had. So there's that a whole true. Number of number ones that we're hitting today. I feel bad about not speaking German. I had my brother was the cultural attaché for the Australian diplomatic service, the Australian embassy in Berlin for a number of years. So he speaks German. And my wife is midway through the Goethe Institute lessons around speaking German. So she speaks pretty decent German, and I've got nothing. I apologize for that. I feel like I have enough family influence. I should be able to do a better job.
And that's no problem at all. We're gonna get through this together. It's going to be fine. And and it's also, I think it's good. I think it's people can get used to hearing some English every now and then. I think
we're right.
And if people totally don't understand what we're talking about, I will try to get some sort of transcript thing going, and then, you know, we can hit Google Translate. It'll be all good.
Well, you can also be the guy going, Michael, I don't understand what you just said, so nobody else will understand it either. Say it again, please, for me. And I'm happy to get that guidance.
Perfect. Nice. So before we get into this, two things. One is I usually don't, like, you know, like I'm very new to this whole conversation situation. So I usually don't do these things so much as like a classic kind of interview, because I'm no interviewer, I'm no journalist in any kind of way. So it, you know, it's more like a conversation. Obviously, I have a few things that I'm interested in. I want to ask you, I'm very curious about a couple of things that I almost am not going to be able to shut up about, like agreeing with you all the time. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm gonna pretend like it's really a question instead of me agreeing from the beginning.
You know, for me, my favorite versions of these are where you have like two colleagues and they just go somewhere interesting. So I don't need to tick any boxes. I'm like, you lead and I'll follow, and we can have a great conversation together. And that's wonderful. Interesting for people, I think.
Wonderful. Very great.
Yeah.
So the one thing that I would like to start off with is it's pretty much in the beginning of your current book, right?
Yeah.
And it's a sentence that goes, staying curious a little longer.
Yeah.
And also, you know, one of the first chapters is how to stay curious a little longer, right?
Right.
So here's what I would like to inquire with you about. Why? What is the quality of being curious, and how is it in this whole coaching context, but also in a life context or in an interpersonal context? Like, what's it about curiosity, and what would you say, like, why it would be important and how we could do it? Like, what, talk to me.
Sure. There's a lot in that question. But it gets to the very heart of what I try and champion, which is, you know, in the end, what I think is a really powerful way to show up in the world is, just as you said, can you stay curious a little bit longer? And as a counter to that, can you slow down the rush to action and advice giving? because my hypothesis, my belief, which is borne out by every interaction I have, is most people are advice-giving maniacs. I mean, they love to leap in and give advice. Mm-hmm. And there's a bunch of reasons for that, which I will probably get into. But, you know, why curiosity? Well, you know, first of all, you know, what's interesting about your question is I suddenly realized, like, I don't have a handy definition of what curiosity is.
Okay, great.
And you think
curious about it.
Yeah, exactly. You think that I should have come up with that by now, but I don't. For me, it's a willingness to stand in the grayness, the ambiguity,
yes,
of not knowing. Mm-hmm. And that's both exciting and dangerous place to be. You know, it's exciting because it is a place of possibilities and opportunities and different pathways and choices not yet made. And it's dangerous because all of the above. I mean, your little amygdala, that lizard brain at the back of your brainstem, it loves certainty. It loves clarity. It loves direction. Mm-hmm. So when you step into a place of curiosity, there's one part of your brain that's going, don't do it. Make a decision. Get going on it. Any decision is better than staying curious a little bit longer. So you're really, one of the things that curiosity is doing is it's moving you to that kind of higher function of your brain, the prefrontal cortex. It's saying, this is a place where you can in some ways be most human, because you can imagine the future and you can imagine possibilities and you can see different options. And all of that comes through that practice and that discipline and that valuing of curiosity.
Now, some people might say, well, how is that? But if you say, you know, your brain wants to make a decision or your brain loves clarity, right? A lot of people will say, well, don't spend so much time like lingering and don't spend so much time being undecided. And I would quote you, make a decision, any decision, and just leap and see how it goes.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that's not really what we're trying to get away from by being curious, right?
Yeah, you know, so I guess I would start with an article that appeared in the Harvard Business Review in the year 2000 by Daniel Goleman. Mm-hmm. And it's called Leadership That Gets Results. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about it is he says there are six different styles of leadership and they all have their moment and they all have their appropriate time and they all come with pros and cons, with prizes and punishments. Great leaders know when to use all six of those. Typical leaders use two or maybe three of those. And, you know, I grew up reading Tom Peters, and one of Tom Peters' first kind of snappy liners was, don't aim, then fire. And it's like fire, then aim, like fire first. And there's absolutely a place for being bold, taking the leap. I mean, Jim Collins, another leadership writer, and the book that followed Good to Great, he says, look, the way you build strategy is you fire bullets and then you fire a cannonball. And firing bullets is this kind of activity of trying some stuff out, small, mm-hmm. cheap experiments. But part of the reframing of this is understanding that moving to action can be an expression of curiosity. When you're like, hey, we're just testing some stuff out. This is a hypothesis. This is mm-hmm. a beta test. Mm-hmm. This is a bullet, mm-hmm. which we're firing out going, what does this mm-hmm. tell us about where the real target is? What more often happens, I would suggest, is people go, we've got the answer. This is the answer. Do the answer. And it's not a test. It's a final decision.
Yeah.
And that's where curiosity is lost. And the price that gets paid, you know, in the context of organizations anyway, you know, there's a way that the organization becomes less agile, less innovative. There's a way that the team can be wasting time, not being focused on the right thing, mm-hmm. not coming up with the best solutions for the right thing. And as an individual, you're just like, you're not tapping into what potential you have. And, you know, that's a loss for you and it's a loss for those around you as well.
Yes, because you're also not tapping into the potential of the person you are speaking to, for example.
Exactly.
So when you said you shoot a couple of bullets or you shoot many bullets and then you shoot a cannonball, it seems to be like those bullets, in the spirit of curiosity, those actions could be actions that are also questions.
I love that.
Let's shoot this bullet, you know, and the question in the bullet is, well, if we do this, what happens?
Right.
So in a conversation, this could maybe be something like, well, what would you say about this, right?
Yeah. And
make a suggestion to the person, which is not a directive. It's not like, let me tell you what your problem is. It's more like, what would you, how
so, do you? So part of what you need to navigate with that, Michael, is I'm certainly agreeing with you in principle. When you gave that very specific example, you know, have you thought about, did you try this? The danger of that is that's potentially a fake question.
Sure.
Because depending on the power structure,
it's a fake suggestion.
Yeah, it's like when you're exactly when your boss goes, hey, what about this?
Sure.
That's not really a question. That's
sure.
not really a possibility piece. That's a, in most contexts, that will be taken as, oh, that's what my boss wants me to do.
Of course.
So,
yes.
You know, if somebody comes to me going, here's the thing that I'm wrestling with, mm-hmm. you know, I've got a little script. It's like a learned behavior. That is a way of helping generate bullets, you know, possibilities. I go, hey, Michael, that's great. I love that. That's your challenge. I bet you've got some ideas on how to tackle that. What's your first idea?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll have a first idea and you'll go, oh, it's this. And I'll go, I love it. That's brilliant. Anybody called Michael, obviously super smart. And then I go, Michael, what else could you do here? And you'll have something else. And I'll go, Michael, this is great. What else could you do?
Sure.
And then finally, I might add one or two ideas of my own, but I've waited. I've stayed curious longer and I've rushed to offering up my ideas. So my ideas become part of the mix, not the first suggestion that sucks the oxygen out of the conversation. So in principle, absolutely right, which is how do you stay open? How do you test things out? You know, coming back to the bullets and cannonballs metaphor that Jim Collins gives us, part of the danger in most advice is it feels like you're loading the cannonball right from the start.
Yes, sure.
And you know, more than likely, the first shot of your cannonball is not going to be it's not going to be hitting the right target.
Mm-hmm. I have the experience where a lot of times I do have some sort of hypothesis about a situation, right? It's like if it's a one-on-one thing, like you would, I would say to you, Michael, you know, what is your problem? What are you wrestling with? What brings you here? What, you know, what are you bringing to the conversation? And you might say something, and pretty early, I might develop some kind of hypothesis. Right?
Oh, almost instantly,
you know,
like within about 2 seconds, you're like,
exactly.
Oh, I think I know what's going on.
Exactly. Right. Now, my experience has been that pretty much like 99.9% of the time, I was wrong. You know, because, and that was very curious to me, because it's like, well, you know, if I'm wrong, like 50% of the time, okay. Well, if I'm wrong when we're talking about a topic or a subject that I have no experience with, okay.
Yeah.
But even in a field where I might have an expertise, I've made the experience that a lot of times my hypotheses, you know, especially the ones I formed very much in the beginning, they are wrong because they are based on, you know, my perception, my experience or whatever, you know. And when I'm speaking to someone else, I've come to the conclusion that I have absolutely no idea what they're going to do. I have absolutely no idea about anything. So
it's a very powerful place to be.
Yeah,
complete. So here's what I'd say to it.
Sure.
I'd say you're probably a little harsh on yourself when you say 99.9% of the time. You know, I think it's probably more than 1 in 1,000 times you know what's going on, but it doesn't really matter.
Sure.
Let's say it's 90%. 90% of the time you realize that you don't know what's going on. 10%, you're like, oh, I know exactly what's going on. There's two questions to ask here. The first is, even if you know what's going on, mm-hmm. are you sure the other person in the conversation knows what's going on? Because my hypothesis would be at the start of a conversation, most of the time, neither party really knows what the real challenge is. And I think one of the most powerful transitions you can make as a leader is to reframe your role from my job is to have the answer mm-hmm. to my job is to figure out what the real challenge is. Mm-hmm. Because if you build a reputation and build a team and have a pattern of behavior where you're like, we keep working on the right things, mm-hmm. then you win. You just do, because in most situations, people are working very hard to solve the wrong problem. Mm-hmm. But Michael, let's just say that you're in a conversation and you both know what the real problem is. And you're like, oh, this is fantastic, because we're absolutely crystal clear what the thing is that needs to be solved. The next question to ask yourself is, even if you know the right question, the right issue, and you have a really good idea on how to fix it, and quite frankly, most of the time you won't. Most of the time your suggestions, your advice, not nearly as good as you think they are. But let's just pretend for the sake of the argument that, okay, it really is brilliant. Mm-hmm. You're actually at a crossroads. You know, a moment where you have to make a decision about how you choose to lead. Mm-hmm. Because you have an option of saying, I know the problem. I have a really good idea. I'm going to tell them it. Or you have a choice to say, I know the problem. I have a really good idea. What if I help them figure out the answer for themselves? You will be a safety net for them. You're going to make sure that they don't walk out of the door with a stupid idea that won't work. But there's something very powerful in helping them discover an answer for themselves, even if it's different from your answer. Even if it's not quite as good as your answer. I mean, sometimes it will be better, honestly.
Sure.
But sometimes it won't be as good, but it will be good enough.
I think that's that point that you just described, that's a very interesting point, because up until that point, you're dealing with maybe, how can I say it? Maybe you're being smart. It's like, well, mm-hmm. I want them to find the answer themselves. It's more powerful. It's more sustainable. You know, that's like a smart intellectual stance, I would say.
Yes. Right?
But at that point where it's like, okay, if I'm at that point, then I think it's a crossroads. It's like, I can either go left and help them figure out the same answer that I have prepared by like leading.
Right. Exactly. By asking those fake questions. Have you thought of insert my really good idea?
You know, for example, I think maybe that's the point where you have to really like really focus on keeping that curiosity and be staying open to the possibility that your answer is one answer, but there might be another one or a whole array of other answers that are not in your field. There might be, like you said, it might at the end seem to you not as good or whatever, but they might be just different, you know, different solutions to that. I think that's a very crucial moment.
I'm always asking myself, what's the big win here? Mm-hmm. And having the best possible answer to solve the immediate problem is at its best a small win.
Explain that,
please. For me, the big win mm-hmm. is building people around me who are more confident and more competent and more self-sufficient and more courageous and more autonomous. Because what that means is I'm building the capacity of the people and the team that I lead or that I influence. Mm-hmm. And I know that even if I don't give them the exact best answer in this moment today, what it means is for the next month, they won't even come to me the next time they have this problem, because they will figure it out themselves. And it means that when they come to me for help and support, I'm working on higher and higher quality problems to help figure out with them. And you're creating increased capacity so that accountability and responsibility can rest best where it sits most effectively and most efficiently and most empoweringly in the organization. So, I mean, This is actually goes beyond curiosity. It's curiosity for the sake of what? It's like curiosity for the sake of building the capacity of the people around you so they are doing better work and they feel more empowered, better versions of themselves. And that's hard because honestly, those moments where you're like, oh, I've got a really good idea. I know the answer here. I want to tell it to you.
It might also be hard if you have problems with basic trust.
That's right.
You know, because you might say, well, yeah, that sounds like a great idea, but how will I know that that's not going to be a disaster? Or how will I know that, you know, so you might hit that wall, you know?
True. If there is that lack of trust, that's going to play out no matter whether you're giving them the answer or not giving them the answer. There's a brokenness to it. I would suggest that, I mean, that's such a big, it's another big question, Michael. Mm-hmm. It's really big because, you know, I've been led by people who trusted me and I've loved it. And I've been led by people who've not trusted me and it's been a crushing experience. Mm-hmm. But if you're in that position of leading, part of the power might be understanding risk, mm-hmm. which is what's at risk. And of course, this really does depend a bit on your company culture and your organizational culture and your team culture. But I remember being very influenced by a very simple model I heard from a guy called Mike Abrashoft, another Michael, who wrote a book maybe 20 years ago now called It's Your Ship. He was a captain in the US Navy and he took his ship from being the worst ship in the Navy to the best ship in the Navy. Mm-hmm. And he did it effectively by empowering people, by not giving orders, by helping them, by pushing responsibility to the level where it fit best so that everything didn't come up to him to make the final decision. And he talked about the difference between above the waterline mistakes and below the waterline mistakes. You know, which is a very powerful metaphor if you run a ship in a Navy. And he's like, you know, above the waterline mistakes is how people learn. And below the waterline mistakes is how everybody drowns. Mm. So part of your job as a leader is to be really clear about what's at risk. And is what's at risk an above the line waterline mistake or is it a below the waterline mistake? Mm-hmm. And what you find is, most choices, most decisions are above the waterline mistakes.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve Bezos, of Amazon fame, talks about it in a slightly different way. He says, look, there's type one decisions and type two decisions. Type one decisions you've got to be really careful about because once you make them, there's no turning back. And they're high risk and they're high risk, full stop.
Yeah.
Type two decisions are decisions that can be undone. You know, you make the decision, you screw up, the mistake gets made, and you're like, okay, we can reverse out of that. We can walk back through the door we came and try again. Mm-hmm. What Bezos says is in most organizations, they apply the rigor and the discipline and the risk management of type one decisions to type two decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And it slows it down. It shuts down innovation. It stifles the culture. It removes autonomy and the like.
I would even say it might be very similar on an individual level, huh? Because how many decisions that you take in your life are actual type one decisions, you know?
I think that's right. I mean, I think there's part of what, you know, this is the recurring theme of this conversation. It comes back to the bullets versus cannonballs, mm-hmm. you know, because that bullets type one, type two decisions, cannonballs type one decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it comes back to the same piece, which is to understand that most of the time on a day-to-day basis, there's not that much at risk. And if you keep trading off a willingness to give people responsibility to allow them to fail and have their back, You're like, even if this goes wrong, we're going to celebrate it because it went wrong. You know, within parameters. I mean, you don't want them to go away going, okay, I burnt down the building. And you're like, okay, that's bad.
Yeah.
But there's a way that you can set up clarity about what's at risk and what are we trying to do and what let's test it out. And this is what you can do and this is what you can't do. You win. I mean, it comes down to, you know, another angle is the lean startup mentality, you know, and the minimum viable product. It is the same. Mm-hmm. Minimum viable product kept saying everything's a type two decision. Keep experimenting and putting it out because it's a type two decision. And by allowing that to work at that level, we learn faster, we grow accountability, we grow empowerment. And that's part of, and all of this comes back to the power of curiosity to understand that you don't allow type two decisions to happen unless you show up with an attitude that curiosity is a superpower, because type two decisions feed curiosity. I wonder how this is going to work.
Mm. So coming back to this curiosity versus advice situation, right? You mentioned it briefly, but could you say a little bit, or could you give a little of your insight into why it is so hard for us to not jump into the advice trap?
Sure.
Why is it so hard to stay at that magical place of curiosity? Why is it something that we have to actually practice and develop?
Yeah. I mean, for everybody listening in, the first thing to just remind you is to say that I'm not against advice. You know, advice is a key part of how we work. I mean, honestly, this conversation between good-looking Michael and not-so-good-looking Michael, and you can decide which one's
which. I didn't figure that out. I love how also in your book you say, I am very aware of the funny situation that this is a book about not giving advice while it's totally giving advice.
Exactly.
And you said something like, let's just live with this ambiguity. I totally love it.
Yeah, it's like a paradox.
Yeah.
And it really boils down to the fact, Michael, that advice giving is an important part of how we operate as human beings. So this is not anti-advice. It's just saying when your default response, when your habit, when your immediate reaction is to move into advice giving, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And when you ask, why do we do that? Well, the starting point is to say we do it because we've spent our whole life being rewarded for having the answer, you know, from school, through high school, through university, into our career. It's all about, do you know your stuff? So there's just, you have to acknowledge that this is a very deep cultural expectation. Can you pass the test? Will you be an A student? But I think there are kind of deeper reasons behind that. And, you know, in this new book, The Advice Trap, the rallying cry is tame your advice monster. Mm-hmm. And I think there are three personas of the advice monster. And each one of them points to a kind of key, you know, the therapy talk is ego state that we want to defend.
Yeah.
And that advice helps us defend. Mm-hmm. So the three advice monsters, tell it, save it, and control it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell it is, I want to be the smart person, which means I feel the need to have all the answers to all the problems all the time. And if I don't have all the answers to all the problems all the time, I feel like I'm failing.
Yeah.
So there are certainly lots of people who feel that. It often happens for people when they newly become a manager and a leader. They feel the anxiety, like, oh my goodness, I should know everything and I don't know everything. I'm like, that's natural, and it's also impossible for you to not know it. It's impossible for you to know everything. So that's tell it. Save it is slightly different. Save it said, look, your job is to be the rescuer. You know, you need to save everybody. You can't let anybody struggle or stumble or fail or find it hard or find it difficult. You must protect everybody against everything all the time. If anybody finds it difficult, then not only are they going to fail, but you fail as well. That's your job. So number one, tell it, got to have all the answers. Number two, got to save all the people.
Yeah.
Number three is control it. It's probably the sneakiest of the three advice monsters. And control it is about going, look, you don't don't give up control. Keep your hands on the wheel at all times.
Yeah.
You need to control the experience from the start through the middle to the end.
Yes.
You set the rules. You set the timing. You set everything.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you give up any control, then as soon as you invite somebody to step up or lean in or step in,
mm-hmm.
then they will fail and then you will fail. Your job is to stay in control at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And when you realize that these advice monsters, which have honestly served you well enough in the past, because there's been times when you've needed to have the answer.
Sure.
And there's been times when you helping and rescuing people has been valuable.
Yes.
And there's been times when staying in control was the right thing to do. Sure.
And they developed it at some point in time out of a necessity to have those qualities. So it's
perfect. Exactly. They're very fundamental human qualities driven by that amygdala, that brain part of you, that lizard brain that loves certainty. And when it drives you to make it your default response every time, it means that you're managing not from your prefrontal cortex, not from the best part of your brain, the most advanced, sophisticated human part of your brain, but more from your lizard brain. And when you manage from your lizard brain, you manage from a position of fight or flight or faint.
Yeah. Sure.
And that's just not as powerful a place to visit. You know, Michael, I mean, if people are curious about this advice monster idea, at theadvicetrap.com, there's actually a little mm-hmm. questionnaire people can take to figure out which of the three advice monsters is theirs, which one is most strongest in them. So people are welcome to jump on and take the quiz if they'd like to do that.
I've seen that you have very very extensive and very, very attractive and well-structured like online resources.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was very impressed with that. Like, it's really like even in your previous book, The Coaching yep. Habit, almost in the introduction, you mentioned, hey, if you want to know more about this topic, you can go to the site, you can download this information here and this there. Also, now that you're talking with me, you're very generous with sharing information about other authors, inspiration that you have, and so on. And it seems like it's also part of your website. It's like, it's really like, it's not only bringing people to more of you, but it's bringing people to like a broader range of different resources. I think that's very how you call it. I know the German word, but it's, let's rephrase it and say I like that because it's like providing a bouquet of resources.
That's a lovely metaphor. I love that idea of a bouquet of resources. Well, I mean, there's a couple of reasons for doing it. The first is, what I hope for people is that they change the way that they work and live. And actually, it's pretty difficult to do that just by reading a book. Even the best books, they can inspire you, but to actually generate longer-term behavior change is tricky.
That's such a valuable point. It's such an important point to point that out, to have that the inspiration, which might be a book or something, is very, very important and great.
Yeah. But yeah.
You need to actually work on, behavior change, implemented behavior change.
Exactly. And that's, that's hard. that fails more times than it succeeds. Most, we all change our behavior over time, but we've also all tried to give up old habits or mm-hmm. take on new habits and struggled with that. The other thing for me, Michael, is there's a lot of terrible content out in the world. I mean, terrible as in just underwhelming. It's just boring. It's poorly written. It's poorly designed. I get really excited when I find a great teacher. Mm-hmm. Like I want to introduce people to people who've been my teachers, who've given me insight, where I go, this is actually worth your time.
Yeah.
So, I know that most of what I teach is what I would call old wine in new bottles.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like I thought of curiosity was a good idea. Other people figured that out. It's not like I was like, I think I'm the first person ever to go, you should ask more questions. I mean, Socrates kind of had that nailed some time ago. but there is a way how recurring truths and recurring insights need to be re-talked about and resurfaced and repositioned so they strike the right people at the right time.
Mm.
And if I can introduce people to some of my favorite teachers and go, this might be helpful for you, then fantastic. Everybody wins.
Nice. Yes. I was, you know, I was impressed with how that works on the website.
Well,
also, also, I agree with you in the a point that, you know, these ideas don't have to be new, or they don't have to appear out of nothing, you know, in order for them to be very valid, and in order for it to be quite powerful to present them in a new way or in a personal way, because some people might not have the access to those ideas through one certain source, right? But they might have the access through another source. So I think it's totally legit.
And the idea that, I mean, the ideas are the you know, the saying in card playing, they're table stakes. That just gets you entry. Like, ideas are cheap. I mean, like, you know, if you take that earlier book, The Coaching Habit, there's a way you can reduce that whole book to a 200-word blog post. Like, here's what a habit is. Yeah. Here are the 7 powerful questions.
Yeah, you could say these are the 7 questions, yeah.
Sure. And that's it. And you could certainly do that. But part of why the book is written as a book is to engage people, provoke people, encourage people.
Yes.
But I'm like, you know what? Find your idea, but then choose to integrate it. I mean, you know, the cycle of coaching, I think, goes something like this. Insight leads to action. Mm-hmm. Action leads to impact. Mm-hmm. And hopefully impact leads back to insight again. And it just becomes this virtuous circle where all these 3 things feed on each other. You have an idea, you try it out, you see what happens. It gives you another idea, you try it out, you see what happens. That gives you another. And I'm trying to speed up the insight piece so that people have the courage to try the action piece.
Mm-hmm. So when you implement, you work with corporations and you work with, you know, leaders and so on. Do you usually work in a bigger structure? Like, do you work with teams or do you work with individuals? How does it usually?
Yeah. So I created a company. I founded a company almost 20 years ago called Box of Crayons.
Mm-hmm.
And Box of Crayons is a training company.
Mm-hmm.
And its goal is to help organizations shift from advice-driven to curiosity-led. And it works mostly with, I would say, Fortune 100 companies, so big companies like Microsoft and Salesforce and hopefully Google and, you know, and stuff like that. So big global companies typically. For many years, we worked with smaller companies, but we've found that the bigger companies where there's a commitment to shift the culture is really powerful. I mean, Microsoft is one of our key clients at the moment, and we love working with them, in part because Satya Nadella, the CEO, has said, I'm trying to change the culture from a know-it-all culture to a learn-it-all culture.
Yeah.
So it fits really strongly with our commitment to move from advice-driven to curiosity-led. So we love partnering with them and training thousands of people around the world.
I also love that. I just love that phrase, advice driven, curiosity led.
Yeah.
You know, it's like advice driven versus curiosity driven.
Yeah.
Curiosity led. It's very nice.
Thank you. You know, I mean, it's one of those little phrases that, of course, took us about a year and a half to come up with. We worked it and worked it and worked it. And finally, Jill, who helps us with our marketing, came up with that. And we're like, oh, that's the phrase. We love that. And then for me, so that's the Box of Crayons company. At my personal website, mbs.works, that's more about helping individuals and working with individuals on their purpose. And it's a bigger purpose, which is around helping people, you know, be more curious, be more courageous, and to live the best life that they have. So trying to give, it's that same piece around insight and action and impact, that same cycle. And yeah, that's the mbs.works website.
So if you would like to, if people are like, hey, you know, it has a ring to it to say, I would like to be led by my curiosity.
Yeah.
It sounds to me right now like this has a feeling of something. It's an adventure. It's sort of something that feels non-threatening. It feels exciting. It has a little tingle to it, but you know, it's like it's something. You know, so
I like it.
You know, I'd like to be led by my curiosity. That's very, it's very, like, there's a lot of imagination in there, a lot of possibility. So,
see that.
And then it's like, okay, so, all right, tell me, what's the first thing I do? Like, where do I start? Like, where do I pick up the pace? Like, is there something, yeah. Is there something you could generally say?
So it's a broad call to action. So it all depends on how you want to show up. Because you can choose to show up with more curiosity in how you interact with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose to show up in more curiosity around how you choose to interact with your own life.
Do you think
so?
Those have to go together? Or can they
I think there's some basic principles that are the same, but how you choose to enact it might be different.
Okay.
So great. I'll show you how it's different for me.
Great.
The way I try and show up with curiosity about my own life
mm-hmm.
is, this was taught for me by a friend of mine called Neil Pasricha. And Neil Pasricha's book is called, his latest book is called You Are Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And in that he teaches a 2-minute journaling mm-hmm. Process. Mm-hmm. And you know, people have been talking about journaling for a bazillion years, and I've always found it difficult because mm-hmm. I can't be bothered. but here's a very simple exercise and takes 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the start of each day, he goes, I will let go of, I am grateful for,
mm-hmm.
and I will focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find is by me doing that, I become curious as to what's pinning me down. Mm-hmm. What's kind of whirring away in the back of my head and making me a little anxious or distracted,
mm-hmm.
Where the joy is in my life. I mean, there's so much evidence and research on the act of taking a moment to be grateful in terms of how that improves the quality of your life.
Yes.
And then I will focus on is about a commitment to try and have more impact in this world. What's my great work that I care about?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a curiosity piece for me, even though mm-hmm. there aren't questions, they are questions really. Because mm-hmm. when you write out the, you know, I will let go of, the mm-hmm. question there is, what do you attach to that you need to let go of?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm grateful for, the question is, what are you grateful for? You know, and I will focus on, the question is, what will make the biggest difference today? What matters most today?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really helpful for me.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of if you're thinking that, okay, Michael, that's nice, but I'm trying to be more curious as how I show up as a contributor, as a manager, as a leader in my world. How do I do that? Well, what doesn't work is just listening to this conversation and going, that was amazing. I'm just going to try and be more coach-like in the way I interact. I think you have to get really specific and, you know, here's an invitation. If you go to thecoachinghabit.com, I think you can download the first 2 or 3 or 4 chapters of the book. There's certainly a big percentage you can download. And chapter number 1 is how to build a habit. And it's really useful, not just if you want to be more coach-like and more curious. It's just in general. This is a way of building better ways of living.
Yeah, and there are so many misconceptions about habits. You know,
right.
you mentioned it as well, the 21-day rule, which is
terrible. Totally
something somebody just made up, and it has no scientific basis. Somebody just wrote it. Like, when I was researching for my book, I think I even stumbled upon like the origin of the myth somewhere. And
I tell you what I've heard the origin of it is. It's a Brazilian plastic surgeon who noticed that after people had nose surgeries, kind of got a better nose.
Yeah, exactly.
It took them about 3 weeks to kind of get used to what their nose looked like.
Exactly.
And somehow that became 21 days becomes a habit.
Ridiculous is that? But it's something that really sticks, like from everything, from fitness programs to diet programs to anything, like or meditation.
We all want it to be true.
You know, it's like if you meditate for 21 days, like every day, it's like it becomes your habit. It's like,
no, I wish it did. Because I've meditated 21 days in a row. It didn't become a habit.
Dude, I've meditated 10 years in a row. It's not a habit. you know.
I think if you're wanting to bring curiosity into your daily interaction, it's like it's think about building a habit. So here's what I mean by that. Pick a person. You know, that pick the person you're like, that's the person who I'm wanting to shift this relationship with just a little bit.
Nice.
Pick the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, is it in your daily check-in? Is it your weekly check-in? Is it just the next time you see them? And then the new habit formula, which is the first chapter of the coaching habit, says, when this happens, instead of, I will. So when this happens, I meet up with Michael and we have our weekly one-to-one. Mm-hmm. And he starts complaining about his life because, you know, he always does. Instead of me leaping in to try and fix it and save it and solve it and make it feel better for him, I will, and this is where the curiosity comes in, I will ask a question. I'll go, hey, Michael, what's the real challenge here for you? And that kind of deliberate, I'm going to try and practice it with this person in this moment with this question, just gives you a better chance of actually getting it done. Certainly a better chance than just going, that was amazing, Michael. I'll just try and ask more questions. That won't work.
And also it's a very specific thing, because if people ask like, oh, you know, where should I start? I don't even know. This is something very specific. It's just specific. It's like,
that's right.
Okay. Pick one person or one circumstance or one recurring thing that happens that is, you know, that is already a habit because it recurs, it's happening. Yeah. It's, you know, and then just say, what is it about it that you would like to change? And then there's also a point there where you say, instead of, I will focus on, and here it comes again, that fork in the road. Instead of saying, I will focus on this specific different type of solution, or, you know, instead of, I don't know, like, you know, drinking a coffee, I will do 10 push-ups. It's like, it's like my choice here is to ask a question. My choice is to introduce the curiosity there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And part of what this recognizes is it's hard to change your behavior. So be gentle with yourself as you try and do this, because you'll try and you'll fail. And actually what matters is your recurring commitment to keep trying to do this, because you know, firing bullets and then you fire cannonballs. And what you're doing is you're trying to fire the bullets to figure out how does curiosity work best for you.
Very nice. I like it. So another thing that sort of is going through my mind, right, is when you practice this, maybe you have some advice there, right? You know, that some advice, you know, because you know, the again, I'm losing the English word, but the dichotomy between, you know, not wanting to give advice and then giving some advice.
Yeah, there's a tension. Between I don't want to give advice, but I really want to give advice.
Yeah, exactly. So, and exactly about that topic. Like, would you have some? Or let's say like this: How could you support someone to stay curious? Let's phrase it like this: How could you support someone to stay curious in these crucial moments where the person realizes, I really want to give this advice, and it's burning inside of me, and it's really, but you know, like is there something where if people get to that point where they realize that this is what's going on, which is great, is there something that you know?
Well, here's the thing, Michael, the way you said it, if they get to this point when they realize that they want to give advice, if you get to that point, you've almost won already, because most of the time we just start giving advice. We don't even realize that we want to give advice. We just start doing it. And that's why it's useful to understand the habit piece, because with a habit, you can't think yourself out of it in the middle of it, because the whole point of a habit is it's a unconscious action. It just starts happening in response to stimulus. So they start talking, you start giving advice, and then suddenly halfway through you suddenly realize you're giving advice and you'll go, what happened? So part of what's helpful is to start understanding and identifying all those moments which trigger you to want to give advice.
Yes.
You're like, oh, you know, every time whenever Michael talks about podcasting, I always want to give him advice and I just launch into it. So I've got to learn how to ask a question. When I have a conversation with Michael about his podcast, mm-hmm. and he starts complaining about the quality of his guests, instead of saying, you should talk to Michael Bungay Stanier, I will ask a question.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So I preset myself around that. If you notice that you want to give the advice and you haven't yet given it, well, then you've won because yeah. you're already there. You see that the moment and you get to go, hey, let me just experiment staying curious a little bit yeah. longer. Let me see if I can just ask one more question.
Yeah. Or let me just relax that here. Relax that urge.
Just relax. Just go and ask, and what else? And what else is the default easy question? Well, what's and what else in German, Michael?
And what else? Und was noch?
Perfect.
Und was noch?
The coaching habit has been translated into German, so it's available in German.
Yeah, I know. Yes.
And the Advice Trap, the new book, has we've just sold the German rights, so it will be translated. Yeah,
I was looking for it in German. It's not. It's also the Advice Trap is also not yet out as an audiobook. I realized.
Not yet.
Yeah,
so we're trying to produce a cool audiobook. So it's not mm-hmm. just an author reading through it.
Yeah,
but I think I'll be doing some of the recording, and I want to make mm-hmm. it a kind of more and different to the book. So we're working on something cool around that.
That's nice. I love that because the version that I have as an audiobook of The Coaching Habit, you did not right. read it yourself.
That's right? right.
And I was a little bit, like, I always love it when the authors themselves read the books because there is a little different, you know, it's got a little different ring to it, you know?
Well, I think for The Advice Trap, I'm going to read it. And or at least some of it. I'm playing yeah. around. I'm experimenting even as we speak around what we can do to make it fun.
Nice.
So in that moment, stay curious, ask another question, see if you can stay curious for another 30 seconds. That's all you need to do.
Mm. Yeah, and also thank you for going one step before that, which you're absolutely right. The moment that you realize, this is what's happening, it's like you're already pretty much winning.
You're ahead of the pack because most people don't even realize that they're giving advice. So you're already on the way to winning and already on the way to changing your behavior. So well done you.
And but I thought it was very valuable when you said, well, also there, try to identify your habit. Like also bring the curiosity there. That's also a curiosity exercise. It's like, okay, let me be curious yeah. about this question. Like where do I usually, you know, want to give advice, or where does my curiosity usually, where is it usually overrun by reactivity?
Yeah.
No, like where does that happen? Let me identify a couple of those situations. And also what I find, what really helps me, and I'm interested, you know, what you have to say about this is whenever I think about a situation like that, whenever I ask this kind of question, there is a feeling attached to it.
Mm.
It's almost like I can physically experience like
sure.
that's what it feels like to be sort of, it's sort of like a pull or something, you know, that's like, you know, like the words you have to wrestle with the words. It's like, I want to say this, I want to give this advice. So for me, it's also paying attention to this physical feeling.
Oh, that's really good.
Oh, here it comes. Because
I agree with you, which is like there is a stance your body will be in, which is in your advice giving stance. Like for me, I'm sitting slightly forward on my chair. My shoulders have gone up a bit. I'm doing my fake nodding, which is I've stopped listening to them, but I'm pretending I'm still listening to them. So I'm nodding my head like I'm still listening to them. And I can feel myself tensing up. If I'm being curious, I sit back a little bit. My buttocks, my bum relaxes a little bit. My hands are probably on the table or down by the side rather than a more kind of up ready to talk. Mm-hmm. So there's a way that you can prime yourself by your physical stance. Because I'm a big believer that the body leads the brain. Yes. So if you want to stay curious, mm-hmm. sit in the way you sit when you're being curious.
Sit in your curious pose.
Yeah, because then your brain goes, oh, it looks like we're being curious at the moment. So I'll ask mm-hmm. a question.
Uh-huh. How did you figure out what your curious pose or your advice pose, or like, how did you figure that out?
Once you realize you have a pose, you can just notice it. Like, to the people listening, it's like, notice what you, how you are. You know, just as Michael said, what's the feelings? What's the stance? What, how do you sit? You know, how do you put yourself into a place of curiosity? Notice what the triggers are and then go from there. How do you put yourself in a place of advice giving? Notice what the triggers are. Notice how you show up physically and go, oh, that's interesting. I sit forward on my chair. I wouldn't have known that unless I stopped and noticed myself going, oh, look at me sliding forward because I'm moving into advice giving mode.
Ah, that's very nice. It reminds me of this story. I mean, it's a little connected, but it's, yeah, I guess it's connected. It's around something else. It's around like performance. I guess it's like a very famous like Tony Robbins story, the one with Andre Agassi. I'm sure you've heard that story. Andre Agassi, the tennis player, he used to be top of the world.
But I then, remember. But long, then he, long hair, then not yeah, long hair. Married exactly. Brooke Shields, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and then he sort of you know, he had a very bad streak for a while, right?
So that's right.
So he had a coaching meeting with Tony Robbins, and Tony Robbins, and he really doesn't want to go, and he's like, man, I don't know, like, you know, this coaching thing, like, what does it do for me, whatever. So what they do is they just watch a video of Andre Agassi when he was when he won his like big championship, right? And Tony Robbins is just like, hey man, like, remember that moment, like, as you see yourself, like, remember how that felt, you know, like, yeah. So he's actually reliving the moment, he's feeling it, and he's watching himself sort of in that posture with that whole, the right. whole attitude around him. And then he pops in another, back then it was like VHS tapes, I think, he pops in another VHS tape, and he says, well, and this is the loss. And I mean, this is a kind of a populist example, but you know,
but really helpful.
Supposedly he walks on the field, you know, a little yeah. bit slouched, you know, he doesn't do this really. With the hair. He has another demeanor about him. And Tony Robbins asks him like, hey, do you remember how you felt then? And he says, yeah, I remember walking on the field and feeling like, oh man, I think this guy's going to crush me. Whereas the first time he was feeling like, oh man, I'm going to come out. This is my totally. Day. I don't even know who's on the other side of the court. It doesn't even matter.
Doesn't even matter. Exactly.
Right. And then Tony Robbins kind of, he said to him, well, you know, just for shits and giggles, kind of, you know, why don't you in this moment, like, stand the way you were standing the first time, and like you walk, and now you're going to hit the ball and like take the racket, hit the ball just in that physical stance, you know?
Yeah.
And like I said, and he did actually, the legend goes, he did actually go back and win the world championship again.
That's perfect.
Right. So that's a great,
it's a really
Hollywood
powerful
kind of example. But it's about,
you know, I have a
physical manifestation of or analyzing how you physically connect certain postures or certain things with mental states.
Right. You know, I have a little card I carry around with me when I'm speaking or facilitating. It's called my This Not That card. And it's pairs of words. Mm-hmm. And on one side is the this column, which is what I'm like at my best. Uh-huh. And on the other side is the not that column, which is what I'm like when I'm 10% off my game. Mm-hmm. It's not when I'm at my worst.
Yeah.
Because that's not interesting.
Yeah.
It's when I'm just slightly off, when yeah. I'm slightly intimidated, when my energy is slightly down. And it helps me remember what I'm like at my best. It's the equivalent of watching that VHS tape of winning the US Open or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So, you know, for me, I'm like curious, not a know-it-all. Stepping forward, not stepping back, holding it lightly, not taking it seriously. Mm. And all of those, they have their origin in specific moments that I can remember. So I'm like, I know this moment. I remember this teaching moment when That's I was this. And yeah. I was like, I kind of screwed it up. And it's just a way when I'm feeling off my game to reconnect to the better version of myself and invite myself into that physical way of being.
It's a little bit like a checklist too. It's like, hey, am I really
yeah.
sure? Am I taking it lightly, or is it a bit serious in this moment? You know?
Yeah, and you know, I find I use it most when I'm off my game, and I'll look for the symptom. I'll go, oh, you know what? I feel like I'm taking it too seriously. So what's the opposite of that? Hold it lightly. So what's it like when I hold it lightly? Oh, look, everything changes.
Hmm. So do you have that? It's a sort of like a business card sort of situation.
Yeah, it's like it's the size of a business card. It's just a hand drawn line down the middle, and then mm-hmm. I got it laminated, and I just carried it around with me.
That's very, very cool, man. And also, I love that it's not particularly intellectual exercise. We're like, okay, I'm going to sit down for 5 minutes and think about what are my good and my bad parts. But what you said as well, all of these are actual. They come from an actual, specific, teachable moment.
Yeah, they're all memories.
Or memory or situation. Yeah, yeah. So it's already embodied. It's already lived.
Exactly.
You know,
it's trying to get embodied wisdom and reconnect to that. Absolutely.
That's great. I think I'm going to ask people to send it.
It's buried in a cupboard behind there, so I can't whip it out and show you, but otherwise I would.
That's a good sign though, because that means you're totally on the positive side. You know,
that's right. I'm not traveling very much at the moment.
Who is these days?
Huh? Yeah.
Let me ask you about that. Do you see a shift in what you talk about with clients or how you work with clients in this specific situation?
Not so much. I mean, Box of Crayons is still focused on that shift from advice-driven to curiosity-led. And that's, I think, our belief is that's such a foundational leadership skill. Now, whether you're in a pandemic or not, whether you're working from home or not, you still need those skills to show up.
Maybe the aspect of curiosity, is very, very important now, even, you know, in a situation where, I mean, we are talking about a situation of there is this, in the beginning, you were speaking about a certain gray area where we feel very highly uncomfortable because we would like to make sense right away. We would like to have an answer right away. So this is where our
sense of crisis, for sure.
And this plays out in like small situations where it's like, oh, we don't have the answer yet. Or, you know what I mean? Right. So that's like a training ground, even maybe, you know, for a big situation like this, because if you can stay open, if you can stay curious in this kind of bigger situation, you know, I think that could be a very valuable asset, very valuable mind state even here.
Well, for me, you're asking people to find the right balance between certainty and curiosity. The pressure is to drive to certainty because we all want black and white. And when there's so much gray, it's not comfortable. That's why we're all suboptimal at the moment, because we're all under this ongoing, never-ending anxiety about what's actually happening. So it's not to replace all of that with curiosity, because certainty is part of what is required at the moment. But if you're all certainty all the time, that's not going to work either. So I think that curiosity is a key part of it.
And certainty in this kind of situation, as in the small cases and in the big case, might drive you towards picking the first kind of solution, the first kind of answer.
You got it.
You know what I mean? And that might not always be, you know, the most beneficial.
It probably won't. I mean, the research shows that the first challenge is almost never the real challenge. First answer is almost never the best answer.
Tell me about
curiosity can help with both of that.
I read that also in your book, but tell me about the research in this. Like, how is research into that done? Like, I mean, not as in like the scientific methods, but could you give me an example of how this was looked at?
Yeah, you know, I can't recall the research, the exact research.
Yeah,
but. You know, as an example from Chip and Dan Heath's book, Switch, I think it is, they talk about the power of generating ideas. Mm-hmm. And they went, you know what? They did a, they found a researcher who'd done research around how ideas work in organizations. And he found that 73% of ideas were binary. Meaning, mm-hmm. should we do this or should we not do it?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Those ideas had a failure rate of over 50%, which, and if you're like, is that good? Is that bad? Well, apparently teenagers have better decision-making outcomes than that. And teenagers, as we now know, their brains are kind of reforming.
Yeah.
So they're like, they're cognitively disabled. Yeah.
My son is 15. I would never say that, but
you're probably leaving that.
You just said that. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Here's what they found. By adding just one additional option, which comes from curiosity, the failure rate dropped from over 50% to about 30%.
So it's going from, should we do this, yes or no? It's going
to, should we do this or should we do this or not? Mm-hmm. And the failure rate dropped down to about 30%. So almost halved the failure rate by simply the ability of staying curious a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And there's, you know, there's just there's a ton of research just saying, you know, anytime somebody has a first articulation of the challenge, it's their best guess. It's their stab in the dark. It's their, it's rarely been stress tested to figure out what the real challenge is.
Yeah.
So that question, what do we think the real challenge is here, is a very powerful one to kind of step back and go, are we focused on the right thing here?
Mm-hmm. And this also brings me back to something in the beginning where you said, well, okay, what's your next idea? And what's another idea that you have? And so on. To just keep curiously inquiring into the same question. I even pose a very specific question to myself.
Yeah. You know?
And then I give an answer. And then I ask the question again. And then I give an answer. I ask the question again.
What else is a very good coaching question? It's almost my favorite coaching question.
I might even do that for 10, 15 minutes and really go for it. And then some of the answers might be just ridiculous. But sometimes in the 15th answer, usually there's something in there where I'm like, wow, like I never would have thought of that. Like I never would have thought that this is connected to this issue or something. And the only way I got to it is by just, you know, asking, by literally staying curious and by asking again and again and again. And then I draw a blank. I'm like, okay, this time I really have no feeling. So I ask it, right? I ask it again and I have no feeling. And the third time it's like, well, I don't know if that plays into it, but maybe if I would think twice about it, like this could be related. And then something appears where it's like, whoa, it's very surprising, because even if I practice this with myself, I have no idea a lot of time about something that reveals itself after a period of that.
Part of the magic of our brain. You're like, I didn't know I knew that. Yeah, I didn't know I thought that. I didn't know that me asking that question would somehow make some connection somewhere in my brain that's generated this new insight or this new idea.
Is there something in your field of knowledge or something that you have an experience with where, here's something that I found, for example, right? I might need a few sentences while I'm talking, this is one thing in my experience. A lot of times, like also while I'm talking or while I'm formulating a question, while I'm doing it, I'm sort of establishing it. I'm thinking it, you know? So I'm staying curious with this as I'm talking. For example, you know, I make music. I've released a bunch of albums and so on. I write the lyrics. So a lot of times I realize that when I sit down to write, And I'm quite open-minded. I don't have like a fixed idea or something like that, you know, and I just let it flow. Like the first sentences I write, the first ideas that I have, I usually just end up taking them out at the end.
Right? Yeah.
But they sort of have to be put out there. They sort of have to, it's like, you know, I sort of have to ramble on for a short while and then something concrete or something more in a coherent direction or some underlying idea or something can reveal itself after I've sort of spread it out the beginning. Is there something, I guess what I'm asking is if you're aware of any scientific background to that, like if there is something.
You know, the person I probably point people to is to a guy called Cal Newport, who wrote Deep Work.
Oh, yeah, and I actually read that book.
It says very much what you're saying, which is that you have to wade through the shallows before you get to the depths.
Yes.
You know, I know when I'm writing, if I'm writing a book, the first chapter is almost always terrible. It's like my warm up. It's the stuff I've got to get out of my own way before I can start writing about the interesting stuff.
Yeah.
So pretty much whenever I write a book, I'll probably just scrap the first 20 pages so that, because chapter two is where it gets interesting. So I'm like, why don't I just remove all the boring stuff and just keep the interesting stuff? It's like if you're writing an article, quite often the first paragraph is not that good because you're like, I'm just trying to figure some, I'm just trying to get going.
Figure it out, yeah.
And so I heard a useful metaphor for this, and I think it's called the Stockholm bus metaphor.
Okay.
Let's pretend it is. I'm sorry, whoever came up with this, I apologize for getting this slightly wrong. But when you look at the Stockholm bus routes, you see that whatever bus you go on, honestly, for the first 3 miles, they all carry this over the same basic three or four routes. Mm-hmm. And if you get onto a bus and you're like, okay, I'm getting onto a new bus, and you get onto it and you're like, ah, man, this is the same route as the old bus went on. This isn't very interesting. So you get off and you go back to the station, you get on another bus, and you're like, okay, new bus. And you're like, oh, man, it's the same route again. And actually, the routes only start diversifying after the first 5 miles. Because after the first 5 miles, they split. And after the next 5 miles, they split again. And then they find their independent route. Mm-hmm. So there's something very powerful about that as a metaphor to say, you've got to stay on the bus for a while. Go through the obvious stuff to get to the interesting stuff.
Mm. Very nice. Let me ask you, it's not a coaching question. I'm not aware of how much time you have, and I don't want to go over your schedule. And
I probably need to be in the last 5 minutes or so.
Okay, that's perfect. We're well past an hour, so you know, I was just good, great. So, I mean, very honestly, I could ask many more questions.
This is a conversation that could go on for many hours and over. We should crack some beers open and have a beer or two or something.
Man, honestly, I was just diagnosed with gout. So for me, it's probably more of a glass of wine than a beer from now on.
Okay.
It's very bad because I'm in that respect, very German. And
yes.
I'd love to keep enjoying my beer, but no, I'm going to be curious about wine now, I guess. You know,
there's some very nice German wine. There's some upside to all
true.
Of that.
Very true. Yeah. So thank you very much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. And also, oh, the very last, I think, here's something we haven't talked about. We can make this brief, but I'm really interested in this. We are even speaking to each other because we have received, like I received an email by a person that you know or that knows you. And this person suggested to me and my team is like, hey, Mike, you should meet Mike, you know?
Yes.
You guys should talk to each other and you should
Oscar, I think his name is. Yeah.
Yeah, and you should be on this podcast. And I was very intrigued because I was like, wow, this is unusual. And let me see what's happening here. And so it went through some divergence because at the time the email reached me, I hadn't started speaking to people on my podcast yet. But now here we are. Do you know who this, like what's your connection to this person? Do you know?
So his name is, I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but it's something like Oscar Triboli. And he writes about deep listening. And he subscribes to my newsletter and follows me in various ways. And when the new book was coming out, I just put a note in my newsletter going, hey, what are the interesting podcasts that you think should be know about me and interview me?
Yeah.
And Oscar, more than anybody, actually rose to the challenge and went, here are five that I think are really good and I'm going to make the introductions and make them happen.
Oh, nice.
So it was a very lovely act of generosity on his part. Yeah.
Very sweet. Did you end up on all five?
I didn't, but I think probably 3 out of 5.
All right. Okay. Very nice. Very cool.
Yeah. So it was a nice treat. And then honestly,
thank you, Oscar. Shout out to Oscar.
Thank you, Oscar. and kind of thank you in a weird way to the pandemic, which kind of accelerated you going into virtual recording. Cause I know your team originally wrote back going, we're not kind of doing that. Bad luck. I was like, okay, well, never mind.
But you wrote a beautiful response. You wrote something in the likes of, well, in that case, you know, you can either keep on doing what you're doing, or you could be curious.
Yeah, I remember that. I was like, you know, I could be the first person you do in English and do remotely.
Exactly.
And it came to pass.
Exactly. And I was like, man, I like this guy. I like the answer of this person. You know, let me check that out. And then I looked at it and I was like, oh man, I'm totally, I downloaded your first book, not your first book, obviously, which is
the last one, The Coaching Habit.
Yeah, exactly. I looked at The Coaching Habit and I was like, oh man, most definitely. So thank you very much.
This is a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That's honey to my debutante ears. I'm just taking a good stab at it. Thank you. And please, one last time, tell the people where they can find you and where they can get in touch with you.
So I'll give you three different options. If you want to just find out more about me, mbs.works. And to Michael's point, there's a free course at mbs.works called The Year of Living Brilliantly. It's 52 teachers, 52 weeks. Mm. So like a way of meeting some of my heroes and some of the best teachers I know. Wow. If you want to find out more about your advice monster, then theadvicetrap.com, and you can take a quick quiz on which is your advice monster. And if you're in the world of learning and development and you want to find out more about the training that Box of Crayons does, boxofcrayons.com.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michael.
Have a great day. Thank you, sir.
Wenn dich die Themen aus diesem Podcast interessieren, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in mein Buch reinzulesen. Das heißt, stell dir vor, du wachst auf. Die 4O+X-Methode für mehr Präsenz und Klarheit im Leben. Wenn du dich über die Themen in diesem Podcast weiter austauschen möchtest, dann lade ich dich dazu ein, in unsere Facebook-Gruppe zu kommen. Du findest sie bei Facebook unter Stell dir vor, du wachst auf, genau wie der Titel deines Buchs, oder auch unter 4O+X, also viermal der Buchstabe O und dann plus X. Das ist der Name der Methode, die ich in dem Buch vorstelle. Wenn du mir Feedback geben möchtest, erreichst du mich bei Facebook/CurseOfficial, bei Instagram @CurseZeit oder über die E-Mail-Adresse coaching@curse.de. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.